he was told all his life that he'd been abandoned in a shed in Alaska when he was 6 months old and basically left for dead, and then adopted out through the child welfare system to a family that had severe domestic violence problems. When he was 13, his family imploded. His mother moved to Canada with a new boyfriend, and he didn't get along well with his father. So from when he was about 15 till 20 or 21, he went from couch to couch. He became addicted to drugs. He spent time in McLaughlin. He had a really, really rough adolescence. And through the help of one particular social worker that we focus on in the book, named Mildred Mack, he got the tough love he needed. And he was in and out of our shelter 11 different times. But by the 11th time, her voice had sort of become his internal conscience. And he decided that, yes, it was time for him to quit staying out all night partying. It was time for him to get his GED and to start thinking about his future.
Well, Kevin, I'll turn back to you now. How would you say the homeless youth situation in Anchorage compares or differs from other cities?
Well, there's not another city that Covenant House works in with this experience of Arctic homelessness, where young people confront not just the soulful despair of feeling alone in the world and not having a place to turn and wondering why they're alone in the world, wondering why their families don't love them or care for them, but they're also freezing. And I spent with Tina years talking with Paulie about how he did that, moving from couch to couch, spiraling into the rave scene here in town, all-night dance parties, using X, which is a drug that warms the body and which lots of young people in the rave scene at that time, at least, were using, but all which profoundly, struck him down, caused him to lose direction in the world. So he would, from time to time, come into Covenant House, but he wasn't ready to make the kinds of decisions that young people have to make in order to do well in the world. He was filled with self-pity. And what Mildred offered him, because they just did not like each other for the longest time. She is an older African-American social worker who was left by her husband to raise two kids here in Alaska. And she was the last person in the world to purr or sweet talk or hug. She was very much about discipline and organization, and she was firm. And he was this charismatic, charming, athletic, somewhat spoiled and certainly self-pitying adolescent. And he resisted at every turn her coaching, and she resisted his voracious appetite for self-absorption and pity. And so they clashed over and over and over again. And she clashed with him in a loving way, challenging him, you got to get back into school, you got to get off the drugs. And as Tina said, there was just this point in his life where he was going nowhere and was freezing and lost. And all he could hear in his mind's eye was this voice of Mildred saying, you're better than this and you need to make different, better choices. And years ago, when he gave back to the community in a rather profound way by helping to celebrate a holiday meal for homeless young people who were still living at the shelter he'd left and was now in his 20s, he stood up in front of a large crowd and said that although Mildred Mack was the toughest and sometimes the meanest voice that he could remember in his adolescence, that it was the voice that changed his life.
Sort of a mom voice, whether he wanted to admit it or not.
That's exactly right.
The Solidarity Sleepout is on November 15th. It's a culmination of events nationally. What other events are happening, and what's the message that you're sort of hoping to convey beyond the drag of what it's like to sleep outside?
Well, all across the Americas in six countries, including in the United States and including here in Anchorage, celebrities, activists, advocates, business leaders will be sleeping outside and bringing witness to the struggle of homeless young people as winter looms. It just so happens that the first of these sleepouts is tonight in Anchorage, and that's happening in order for me to be able to participate both in the Anchorage sleepout tonight and in the New York City Times Square sleepout on Thursday. So many of the most steadfast advocates and devoted activists for young people in this community will be sleeping outside for periods of time by the Covenant House shelter on F Street at 609 F Street throughout the night to remind all of us that As the temperatures begin to plunge further and as the darkness looms, we get to be the light for young people whose families can't or won't be that for them. We get to be hope for these young people. We get to be love for these young people. And this is a chance for this community to say to all of these kids, it doesn't matter the color of your skin or your nationality or your gender or the circumstances of your birth, all of you have a great promise and a great future ahead of you, and we want to help you get there.
It's a different thing to cover someone doing work than it is to actually kind of immerse yourself in the lives of these young people and mm-hmm. write this book. How has that changed either your own life view or the way that you see the path forward in your work and the lives of some of these young people you profiled?
It was a blessing to be able to use all the skills I'd gotten as a journalist, as, you know, listening and asking the right questions. And what I learned most from it, which, you know, there were many surprises down the road of reporting the book, but I learned that most of the kids, if not all, were there through no fault of their own. They had no say in the matter of whether their parent would die when they were 2 years old and then their other parent would go to jail, so they were left without a person. They had no say in being born into a family where there was terrible domestic violence or child abuse or mental illness. And it made me look at the young people who you see standing outside the shelter doors with so much less fear and so much more sympathy and admiration. One of the young women that we write about was kicked out of her home in Los Angeles because she's gay. Her grandmother said, "Get out of here. You can't live here anymore." The family threw all her possessions in a dumpster, but weeks later, when she was staying at Covenant House, they would still call her up and ask her for help paying their bills. So she was sending home half her paycheck to the family that had kicked her to the curb, and it put her dreams at risk because she was studying to be a massage therapist, but she couldn't afford to go to school and work to support her family. So she ended up quitting temporarily her training so that she could support that family. And I thought, this is someone who everyone should know. She's so admirable and so generous.
That seems to kind of strike a hopeful note that even children that some may say, well, by the time they're 8 or 9 years old, if you haven't been able to help them, it's just going to be too late. After that point, they're sort of ruined for life. And obviously these stories show us that's not the case.
That's just not true. And one of the most hopeful things about reporting the book was discovering the ways in which young people in their teen years, even if they feel so much like the walking wounded, can embrace something good in the world and move forward. One of the happy surprises in the book, our book is bookended by stories of survival in Alaska, the Polly story. But we didn't expect that it was going to be bookended by Polly's story. We thought Polly's story would begin the book and it would end there. But midway through the reporting of the book, Polly received a Facebook message from a woman who said, "I'm your birth mother," this woman who he had heard long ago had abandoned him in a shed. And, you know, Tina, the steady, experienced New York Times journalist, steadied my hand because I thought, what are we going to do now? And they invited Tina to report on their reunion, which occurred in the Midwest. And he learned some new truths about himself, and she learned some truths about him. And Tina, I'll leave it to you to talk about the way that touched your heart, because Tina herself is an adopted child and so found it, I think, moving in a personal way to discover that reunion.
It was wild to see them talking to each other and comparing facial features. You know, he said, "You know, I have your chin, but I don't have your nose. And where did I get this nose from? I hate my nose. Who's this birth father?" And their interactions together were so sweet. It made me really admire Polly for his social graces, because it could have been a very awkward situation. It could have been awkward for them to have an observer there, but they were very welcoming. And I kept thinking about all these missed turns where she'd been counseled not to keep her child because she was 16 at the time, he was 2, and she was homeless. And she went down a spiral of grief and had a very difficult adulthood, in part because she was grieving for him. And he had a very difficult placement where he grew up in an adoptive family that didn't work out for him. And I felt so lucky in contrast because my parents raised me in a very warm and loving home. And it just made me think it's really a lottery when you're born onto this planet as to who you end up with.